Epilogue, Take One. The child is father of the man. I could wish my days to be bound each to each by natural piety. William Wordsworth. It is now mid-August, just over 8 months since my sabbatical started, only a couple of weeks left now until I've fully done my time. Will return to work, which is teaching. Always has been, always will be. Teaching. Everything else on my CV, all those books and articles and titles and awards, I did it so they would let me keep teaching. I just finished teaching one of our summer 6-week session courses, a freshman composition class, primarily as a test for me to see if I still had it as a teacher after my time off at my age, too late now for another foundational reinvention, the kind I've done a couple of times before earlier in my career. When the way I was working in the classroom wasn't working any longer the way I wanted it to work. If my summer course had been a dud, I would not be returning to teach this fall. I'd have to pay back my sabbatical salary, yes, and so what? At least a bunch of young people wouldn't have to endure poor teaching, nor, way worse, would I. Well worth the investment. But it was not a dud. It was fantastic. All still there, one of my best summer sessions ever. There may not be much gas left in the tank, but the octane is still plenty high enough to keep what those two British car guys, Mike and Head, on Wheeler Dealers, call the lump under the bonnet, burbling. Well-tuned, powerful rev, throaty exhaust note. I was, as they also say quite often, chuffed, even gobsmacked. Here is my favorite sentence from the student's course evaluations. This man's mind is very open. He really knows what students need and seek. Thank you, whoever you are, for saying that. We all need and seek someone who is open and knows. When you can't find it, you can still be it. There's my two-sentence teaching philosophy right there, after a lifetime's work of distilling it down to its essence. So, as I said, I was hoping it would in my book's opening. All of this work has, in fact, turned out to be the rest I needed to refresh me, or at least keep me steady at a level that satisfies me. I also said at the outset that I wanted to use my time wisely toward rehabilitation, the antidote to recidivism, that always falling backness that so often afflicts our ground-level lives, which I think I have. I see now, looking back, how pertinent that word is, rehabilitation, not just in its penitentiary sense, but in the medical sense as well. Healing is hard. It takes patience and persistence, waiting and work in equal measures. These latter two, waiting and work, well, they are not my strongest suits, but I did both as well as I could during this time. Have I healed myself completely? No. I don't even think that's possible, nor should it be. Life has meanings which need to be held, kept in front of us, used. The deepest scars are the ones that stay, reminders, signs of a lived life. But I wanted, needed, I knew, to clear out a space in there so if anyone else ever wanted to love me, in any of the many ways we can love one another, they could, assured that I would never, ever receive that gift as a replacement for, a substitute for, or worst of all, a forlorn reminder of, the one I have lost. That is a terrible fate to endure, always striving to fill a hole that cannot be filled. I know all of that in my own bones via a lived life. And I wanted to be able to love again like it's now and new. Even if it's only white lines and manhole covers that come my way. Want me to. Are all of these trees that welcome me back every day. I have worked and readied myself for both of those things, and I feel pretty good about where I am with all that. A process of this sort, of course, never really ends. So I will work and wait my way along, hopeful now that the harder parts are past. I had three specific things on my minimal checklist for this interim. Finish this book, check. Make it to my daughter's wedding out west, check. And learn how to be alone. That last one, well, I certainly attended all the classes and turned in all my work on time, only to find out finally that it wasn't even a real course. Alone, I know now, is not something you learn. It's something you do, bit by bit, day by day, just like everything else of value and importance in this life. You can't fake it, and you can't make it go away, just because it's hard or came along unscriptedly. I use three terms in my preface to forecast how this time might feel or go in that respect. Solitude, seclusion, and isolation. None of them turned out to be accurate predictors of what it felt like in the doing. The first one, solitude, I modified then with the adjective pure, which implies an almost timeless contemplative state of mind, the purpose of which is to achieve via transcendence some sort of enlightenment. There was nothing transcendent in my experience of this aloneness, not at least if you imagine it figuratively as going upward out of this material world and into a spiritual one. It was just the opposite. I became vividly conscious of even the most trivial details of my daily existence, cutting up vegetables, doing laundry, vacuuming the floors. I could say that these routine chores turned into profound meditative moments for me. But they didn't. They were real, hyper there while they were there, then done and gone. No residue of wisdom or insight, as far as I can tell, to index any sort of enlightenment. In retrospect, I'm glad it turned out that way. I am neither a saint nor a guru, as I told a good friend over coffee earlier this summer. I'm just a guy trying to get by. The second term, seclusion, well, it wasn't that either. I did sometimes go for weeks without any social contacts outside of the lovely phone calls from my kids, extended philosophical conversations via email with two very smart young friends, and, of course, regular forays out into the world for essential supplies, groceries, say. I set as one of my daily tasks doing one unexpectedly kindly thing for someone who crossed my path, as a way to start to pay back the many tiny kindnesses others did for me, most often unknowingly, when I was shattered last year. To count, it had to be unplanned, just emerging in the moment, and it had to be something I did not in the way that made me feel better, but in the way that made the other feel better. So I had to be paying attention, not on autopilot, some rote cliché sufficing. During my longer wanderings across the savannas of aloneness, that was accomplished via chance email interactions or just social exchanges with the men or women who bagged my groceries. I did a few very big and many very small things of this sort. They are all, I discovered, the same, equally valuable. Someone else's day gets somewhat richer, and it costs me nothing. That's a good investment, I'd say. The last term, isolation, well, that was pretty accurate, at least in that sense of doing time. As I said above, alone turned out not to be something I learned how to do. It was just something I did, may well have to do forever, don't know. It has no beginning, no midterms, no finals. It is life, not school. I wish I could tell you more about this, but I can't. One of the things I kind of expected, based on prior experience, though not to the degree it actually happened, was that I would not remember my daily life in the customary ways we do when we are in constant contact with others, especially intimate others. A husband, a wife, well, they tell their daily story daily to someone else. It's just a natural routine. And by story, I do mean story. We convert the currency of our experience, that fluid whoosh through the world, into a narrative, plotted, a this, then, that, via the alternative currency of words, a medium that enforces segmentation, instilling discontinuity in what otherwise is seamless, whole. The exchange rate between these two distinct currencies, experience, story, varies from person to person and day to day. But when there is no person there from day to day, for long stretches, there is no need to make the exchange at all. The habit is soon broken, that skill forgotten. Life then flows right through like a river and leaves very little residue behind, at least not in any way we can easily share with others. When my kids would call and ask me what was up, I would tell them, laughingly, that I didn't remember exactly what I had been doing the last few days. I did a lot of things, I would tell them, just so they wouldn't worry I was losing my way or my mind. But they just weren't cataloged in there as stories in words. I could tell them quite vividly what I had done that very day, as I always had done with Carol, but that was it. The rest, that great river of my life, had simply swept by. I had lived it, yes, fully, completely, often loved it. I just hadn't bothered to translate it into story, because there was no need to. Simple as that. That was my experience with isolation. Simple as that. And now, having written all of this, I think I understand better why the passage of time has seemed so uniquely strange during this interim. In my next to penultimate entry in this book, number 20, I announced that my clock had restarted, tick-tocking again, finally. I've had my doubts about that in the meantime, not the restart, but whether it's even time that my clock now measures. Its hands advance in such a willy-nilly fashion, no standard unit of progression, each duration like a little bubble that fizzes up, floating extant for a second, an hour, a week, before the next one erupts, and the next. I have the sense quite often that I might actually be creating time, not by slowing it down, but by supplementing it with new time. That seems highly unlikely, of course, but I can't otherwise explain why I have so much of it on my hands, a seemingly endless store of it. I do everything I need to do and still feel like I have all of my time left over. Like all of those beautiful yellow leaves I saw up on the trees overhead as my clock started last fall, when I was sure they were all down on the ground just the day before. Only time can do that with its mysterious comings and goings. I attribute all of this to the fact that my life now has no plan, no anchor, or to use the word I most often turn to, no traction, by which I mean nothing or no one to give it a grip on the ground here, forward-oriented, nothing that sticks or even wants to. So it slips, drifts, spins. That may be true or false. That may change someday or not. Only time will tell, and as I said, time, for me, seems to have a mind of its own, one I can't quite fathom. I truly enjoyed writing and revising this book. I posted it in its first draft form in early January, and then continued to revise and proofread so many typos until the end of February. So if you read it early on, you might want to look at the final clean version. I've probably read it myself 30 times, maybe more, always tinkering, making corrections, the beauty of publishing it on a website I control. And I love it each time. I said in the book how 99% of the value of what I write, for me, selfishly, is accrued in the doing, and that I hope what I write will then find at least one other reader who truly loves and needs it right now, the other 1%. I know this book has found at least one such reader. She told me so in January, only days after I posted it. I was thrilled and fully reassured that I had proffered it in the right way. You may be one such too. If so, I thank you for fulfilling my hope. Self-publishing this book online has proved puzzling to some of you, I know. All I can say is that I had the strongest sense, a mandate even, almost inviolable, arising within me or arriving from without me, not sure which, that this book had to be free. I think you will understand more fully what that word free means by the time this epilogue is done. I realize it will find fewer readers this way, but I believe they will be right readers, you, a few, ears to hear, the ones I care to share my time with. I'm so glad I followed that mandate. I will say it came to me from Carol because I actually believed that. She had the best instincts in the world, and she followed them, always, would not, and could not be deterred. Mine have always been tainted by logic, clouded by reason, susceptible to suasion. When she passed, for some reason, I inherited her trust of these inner voices, the ones that come not from the head, but from the heart. I wish I had done it this way my whole life. So much clearer and simpler. Never wrong. Just around the time I posted my final revisions, late February, a year after Carol died, I had a dream. It was different. I was present in it both as a character and a viewer, the same identity, but separate functions, like that state I described in Coming to Terms, being both an actor and witness simultaneously, both in and out of this world. So I remembered every single detail of it in its aftermath, when I woke up, of course, but without effort, because I had already watched and recorded it all while I dreamed it. It was like viewing a movie you have made yourself. I knew it had to be important. I've been thinking about it over and over in the meantime, what I'm supposed to take from it, do with it. I finally told it to a couple of people earlier this month, and the story came out just as weird, scary, and funny, all the things I like in a poem, as the dream was. I decided this morning on my walk in the woods to write this epilogue and make that dream its centerpiece. The main character in the dream is a young man, about 30, long dark hair, a little curly, flowing to the shoulders. He had a sly, impish smile, a sweet, plain face. He did not look like me exactly, but I knew he was me in the dream, even as the other me watched all the action unfold. Anyway, he wakes up one day, out of the blue, in a small town he has never seen before. He has no recollection of where he came from, who he was, nothing, not even his name. But he is inflamed by a passion to tell everyone he meets two things. This is such a beautiful world. Look at it. Love it. And you have such a good soul. Keep in touch with it. Listen to it. Those two things, exactly. That's all. I add the exclamation points to give a sense of his inner voice when he thinks them, or his outer voice when he says them. As he sets off, he realizes he needs a name, so he looks up to the sky and asks the universe, that is exactly how he termed it, the universe. Who am I? What is my name? A voice answered, "Your name is Free." Thereafter, anytime he met anyone, he would shake their hand and say, "I am free." I'm not kidding. Even in the dream, the me watching laughed at that. It was so cool, this little morality play unfolding in my sleep. Then he would deliver his message, just those two things, and move on. In the beginning, everyone liked him and what he said. It made them feel better, more hopeful, a tad lighter in their step. But after a while, when the implications of his message began to sink in, this started to turn. People became uncomfortable, irritated even, as they realized that they might have to change, give up some things they had come to like if they took his dictums fully to heart. They preferred the lives they were used to, the amenities they were accustomed to, a kind of thoughtlessness that demanded little and gave a lot back, at least in the currencies that everyday culture traffics in and values. So they started to grumble, resist. As it happened, the only ones who continued to value and listen to him were young children, who had not had time to forget yet what he knew, understood it implicitly. Their parents did not like this either, grumbled more. The powers that be in the town, and that is exactly the term in which they were cast, even as they remained invisible, off-screen, throughout, no names, faces, anything, heard all the grumbling and decided that Free needed to be stopped, that the adults were getting chafed and feared their children were being tainted. The status quo had to be firmed up again, reasserted. Their first instinct was just to kill him, but they knew it had to be done indirectly, for obvious reasons. One of the members of this group said he knew a man, one of the townspeople, who truly hated Free, already wanted to kill him, but was disinclined to suffer the consequences of that act. They directed their colleague to approach this man, tell him he could kill Free without any fear of reprisal. One evening, Free was sitting with some friends on a screened-in front porch of one of their homes, laughing and goofing around. The only things I ever saw Free do in the dream, besides delivering his message, always with a beaming, off-kilter smile, were laugh and goof around. The hired gun happened to walk by right then and saw him up there. He hurried up the steps, came in through the screen door. It was one of those old-fashioned wood-frame doors on taut spring hinges that closed with a whack behind anyone who entered, which it did, whack, after this man passed through. You may be old enough to remember those doors, common on screen porches back in the 50s and 60s. This is a good example of the level of detail I recalled from this dream by being in it as a witness. Wood on wood, whack. The man had a holstered six gun slung Western style on his right thigh. He started to reach for it. Free knew he was about to be killed, but it didn't seem to bother him at all. He just stood up, walked up to the man, close, looked him in the eye, like he was seeing something beautiful deep inside, something even the man had forgotten. Then he told him, in the most sincere and loving way, "You know, I can see, inside there, you are such a good man." The man stopped in his tracks, then turned around and left, out the door, whack, back down the steps. He never drew his gun. He never said a word. He didn't even smile, oddly. Just left. And that was that. So when word got back to the powers that be that this plan failed, so they told the cops simply to bring him in for a few questions. They would take it from there. Three cops came to escort him in, not arrest or apprehend, but escort, from that same porch. They looked like cops from The Simpsons, kind of jovial, slapstick even, not menacing in any way. He went along quite happily. They all ambled slowly down the middle of the main street all through the town, the four of them, like a little parade, joking, laughing. The sidewalks were lined with people who applauded, said how happy they were to have had Free come to their town. But not one of them either said or did anything to forestall his being taken away. It was just a long goodbye. Some of the children ran out into the street, thanked him, patted him on the back, said they would remember what he said. Free was filled with a calm joy. He knew absolutely in his heart that when he came to the end of that street, far enough out of town to be turned over to the powers that be, alone with them at the edge of the woods, their woods, one of two things was going to happen. They would put a bullet in his head and bury him right there, or send him off to an insane asylum where he'd stay for the rest of his life. Nothing else. One of those two things, both of which were equal to him, not good or bad, just equal. He was placid, happy. He knew, had known in some way from the start, that those are the only possible outcomes for someone like him. And he accepted their coming as easily and smilingly as he had everything else along the way. They all walked on, heading out of town. Then I woke up. I narrated this dream to a couple of friends last weekend. They were very engaged with the story, animated by its telling, until that point. Both were instantly, expressly disappointed that it didn't have an ending. I tried to tell them that it did have an ending. One of those two things was absolutely going to happen to him on the outskirts of town, and they were both the same, exactly equal and effective ways to put an end to a story of that sort. And from the point of view of the powers that be, they're both smart solutions. A bullet to the head outside of town, a quick burial, is so much better for them in the long run than a public execution. Take Socrates and Jesus, for example. and the insane asylum is so much the better for them in the long run than imprisonment. Think Gandhi or Mandela, for example. But it is not a depressing or hopeless outcome, not to Free and not to me, because of the children. We are all, every one of us, children at heart. We know what he knew. It's all there. Just need to remember it. In Rereading Poets, I tell a story about how I cried continuously, inconsolably, scarily, for the whole first year of my life. As the story goes, on my first birthday, I stopped. And, as far as anyone knew, I never cried again. Well, I did, of course, but it was rare, and I tried to do it privately. When Carol died, I cried and cried. Every day now, I cry. Not necessarily about that, could be anything. The trees in the woods, a person on the street, anything. I just cried while I was writing that sentence. That's how close my tears are every minute of the day. I don't know why I cried as a baby or why I stopped. I don't know why I'm crying most of the time I do it now. Same thing with laughing. I do it all the time. For no reason that would be apparent to someone watching, no reason I could provide to such a witness. And, as I've said, sometimes they both come together, a seamless whole, laugh crying or cry laughing, my heart full to overflowing with what I know and what I don't. All unstoppable, so unsayable, laughter and tears, the only way to get it out. I have come to understand over the last year and a half how many different kinds of laughing and crying we have available to us. At least a half a dozen of each, maybe more, distinctly suited for getting what's in there out in the best possible way. I was thinking this morning on my walk that I feel like an Eskimo now, who has to think about his world in English, only one name for snow instead of his seven. Not possible, he might say, or just stupid. You can't possibly believe that this snow and that snow warrant the same name. I wish I had seven names for crying and seven names for laughing, and maybe another seven for laugh-crying or cry-laughing. Then I could get this across to you, why I'm like this now, every day. Carol's favorite Christmas movie, might have been her favorite movie of all now that I'm thinking about it, was A Christmas Carol, the Dickens Scrooge story. She was partial to the older one with Alistair Sim as Scrooge, which we watched together as a couple and then as a family every year. After the Muppet version came out not long after Joe was born with Michael Caine, one of her favorite actors as Scrooge, we watched that one too. If you want to see what I mean by this laugh-crying business, watch the scene in either one, though I'm partial to the Sim rendition. After Scrooge wakes up, no longer what he was. He skips and skitters around the room, laugh-crying like a madman, no reason apparent to anyone who might happen in on him. Like a child. That's me now, no longer what I was, looking like a madman sometimes maybe, if you happened in on me in one of these moments. When I wake up, while I'm walking, whatever, as Scrooge's maid does later in the scene, frightened by what she sees, not because he's dangerous, but because what she sees makes no sense to her. Might, in fact, she fears, be otherworldly. The thing is, if she saw a child doing that, it wouldn't scare her at all, it being just what kids do, instinctively, so charmingly, their being so alive. I have read and reread the things I've written in the aftermath of Carol's death over and over. I gauge my progress, I guess you'd call it, though I think that's a stupid way for me to put it, along my rehabilitatory path by how often and how much I cry and laugh while I'm doing it. I have this idea, again, most likely grounded in stupidity, that when I can get through the whole thing, my essay, this book, without crying and laughing, I will be done, healed, restored, released, whatever. But the child in there knows better, that there is no there to get to. Wouldn't want to go to that there, even if there was one there. All those townspeople lining the route, and then what? The powers that be. I want to cry and laugh every day, just like this, about nothing, about everything. Then I know that what matters most to me, the things I want to tell you, this is such a beautiful world, you have such a good soul, will come out of the deepest ocean of my heart and not the shallow puddle of my head. That you will hear a child's voice in there, your own, the one you love, still love, have always loved, like I love mine, the one who loves us back, the best kind of love, true love. That you will remember everything, laughing and crying, whenever it moves you to do so. If even one of you does that, and I know you will, I have no problem going to the end of the street, just outside of town, handed over, awaiting my fate. I don't fear being dead, though I've seen enough hard dying to have a healthy dread of that. And I don't mind being deemed crazy, though I've had enough trouble in my head to want to do my best to keep the real thing corralled. Either way, I figure I get to be free. Free.